people say it's Satanism. You can say we're a religion, because when you have 5,000 kids all believing in this band, that is a religion.
It is Satan carrying us further and further and further all the time. It's, you know, it's selling your soul.
Nobody's going to stop us.
This is Motley Crue. Their albums for Electra Asylum sell millions, and they're one of the top 10 grossing concert bands this year. Their albums include songs like Bastard, quote, out goes the light, in goes my knife. Pull out his life, consider that bastard dead.
Crew has just finished work on a brand new Motley video. We were there and spoke to the band about it.
Looks That Kill, Motley Crue's new video, is staged in a futuristic heavy metal city, and MTV was there for the making of the clip. Group members Nikki Sixx and Vince Neil explain the concept.
It could be a city of the past, city of the future, and what it is we are like the survivors of it, maybe a Holocaust, nuclear war, whatever, and there are these women who are running wild, and we're like the warriors here. And what happens is there is one woman who is like the goddess, the equivalent of us. And together, we all have looks to kill.
Sixx elaborated on the message the group is trying to make through their music.
Everybody, us, our, and our audience, who we feel is the same, we have so much aggression in us. We're so young, and we have so much, you know, power, energy in us. And instead of us going out and robbing liquor stores and beating up old ladies, we play rock and roll. And that's why we want the kids to come see us, because we're positive.
For Music Television, this is John Paoli in Los Angeles.
See, for me, instead of going out and robbing liquor stores or beating up old ladies, I work here at MTV, but I guess that's a Motley Crue. That's a pretty wild statement, don't you think, to say it? Well, anyhow.
Hello, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and this is episode 2 in the Motley Crue series. So we're talking about their second album, Shout at the Devil, and we've got a round table for this episode. We just got everybody on. We've got Ken Mills from the podcast Zilch Pop, whatever the fuck else.
The man of a thousand podcasts.
Yeah. And we've got Lee McCormick from Tramps Like Us. Hey, Lee.
Hey, how's it going, eh?
And Joe Royland from Sit and Spin. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
So all you guys, I mean, must be well known to anybody who listens to this show regularly. So no introductions needed, right? Everybody wanted to talk about Shout at the Devil, I think. So just, you know, threw everybody on this episode because I thought it would be fun. And you know, this is definitely kind of the pinnacle, I guess, of Motley Crue's career, really. I'm sure we'll have plenty of good stories. As far as my Motley Crue story, I was late to Motley Crue. When I was young, I was very into Def Leppard, Dokken, Twisted Sister, Rat, Quiet Riot, all of the bands except Motley Crue. Motley Crue were the one that I didn't really like. And I remember buying Shout at the Devil cassette, like when I was in high school, maybe even. And finally getting into it, but it took me a while. I think probably one problem is that I'm thinking the first Motley Crue song I ever heard was Smoking in the Boys' Room. I remember the heavy metal half hour on MTV. I would get home from school when I was first getting into this stuff. That would be on like right after I got home from school in middle school. Like, so that would have been like when I was 11 or 12, when that video would have been on MTV a lot. And so that's when I first became aware of Motley Crue, would have been in between Theater of Pain and Girls, Girls, Girls. I wasn't really, I don't know what I was aware of before that. So yeah, they were the one band of all the bands that I didn't really like. And they're still, of all those bands I named off, except maybe Quiet Riot. They would be my least favorite still. I mean, I'm a way bigger fan of Rat and Twisted Sister and Def Leppard, of course, you know. So yeah, they're definitely not one of my favorite bands.
Oh, yeah. I have a bit of the opposite story. They're definitely one of my favorite bands. Like, yeah, as a kid growing up, you know, Kiss were probably my first favorite band. And early 80s, I was starting to fall out of Kiss when they were starting to do all the member changes and they took the makeup off. And then along came Motley Crue, and they slowly crept up to being like probably one of my favorite bands of all time. Like, I don't know what I saw first, if it was the Livewire video or the Looks That Kill video, but seeing that at like 8, 9 years old just blew me away. And, you know, I have vivid nostalgic memories of, you know, 83, 84 when this album came out. I first got the cassette. It was a great story. We were on a family vacation to Disney World in Florida. And before we went to Disney World, we stopped at this record store. And I wanted the Motley Crue Shout of the Devil record because the Looks to Kill video was just being played everywhere on MTV. And, you know, I got that tape and I listened to it in the car ride on my Walkman, like as we went to Disney World with the family, right? So you can imagine like the opening yeah. sounds of In the Beginning and then Shout of the Devil. And here I'm this like 9-year-old kid with my family, like listening to this in the back seat, right?
Yeah.
So I just loved it. You know, like I seen them live. That they played Toronto in June. And, you know, there was a story that they weren't going to let me into the show. They had to get security and management there because I was so young. They were like, he's too young to go to this show. So they finally let me in, you know. So, you know, I just have amazing memories that will never be duplicated from, you know, 84 with Motley Crue in this record for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, you're making me feel like an old man, Lee. That's all right. I discovered really Motley Crue on this album slightly before the album came out. I think I saw them in Kerrang magazine, and kind of like Lee was talking, like I was always a big Kiss fan growing up, and here you see this band and they've kind of got makeup on and they're wearing leather and costumes, and it was kind of a natural progression from Kiss. So I was all about them. But somehow I missed the first album. I don't know how I managed to do that, but I just kind of missed out on the first album and got into them with this album. But they were coming through town on the Ozzy Osbourne tour, and they were doing an in-store at a record town in the mall in my area. So I went to the in-store and just kind of went up to whoever their tour manager or whoever their handler was there, and I'm like, hey, do you think it would be possible for me to get an interview with the band? And they were still like, most people didn't even know who they were yet. They were still up and coming. And he's like, let me ask them and see what they say. And so he went over and talked to them and then came back. He said, you can ask them questions while they're standing here doing this stuff. And they'll be happy to answer anything to while you're at, you know, while they're doing the signing and stuff. So I just stood there. I went with my brother, he took pictures, and I just, you know, I was like 17-year-old kid. I just interviewed him for my high school newspaper. So I was just, it was basic stuff. But we basically just talked about like the new record being out and the upcoming show that night. And the fact that it was a snowstorm that day. And it was kind of like, how do you guys feel about the snow? And they're like, oh, is that what this shit is? Yeah, because they're from California.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it was pretty cool though. So yeah, I got the chance to just say hi to him and all that, and got my album's autograph. Still have those. They use nice silver and gold markers on all the records. So I have like the gatefold. They all autographed it on the inside of the gatefold.
Cool.
Shout out the Devil.
Yeah.
Plus, like they autographed the outside and the inner sleeves too. So very, very cool. Yeah, I have pictures. I'll send them to you. So.
Yeah.
Excellent.
But it was an awesome show. I mean, album was Ozzy was Bark of the Moon was the album he was touring behind then. So yeah. both bands were great, but the Crue absolutely killed it. And I've seen them several times since then, but that show was amazing. And they went home with a lot of new fans that night, and people who didn't already know about them, definitely.
Ken Mills, what about you?
Well, you know, it's been hard to be a Motley Crue fan, right? Mostly because of Vince Neil. And, you know, we'll talk about that later, but if you can get past his singing, which is something that sometimes you need to get past. I remember when this album came out, I had heard the previous album before this. Someone had it at a party and I dubbed a cassette of it. And I really enjoyed that. And I could hear bits of like Cheap Trick and other bands in that. But this was one of those albums that when it came out, you knew that this was a game changer. It felt like this was going to be something really big. And I remember going to James Way and buying it, and it had the pentagram cover, not the picture covers.
Yeah.
I put it on and I thought I was listening to David Bowie's Diamond Dogs, you know, at the beginning. And I mentioned that because this album is full of their influences, from Kiss to David Bowie to Aerosmith and so on and so forth. But, yeah, this was a game changer, and people don't realize how much of a game changer it was at the time.
Yeah, well, I talked to Dave on the Too Fast for Love episode about how, I mean, if you look at the number of bands that a band influenced, Motley Crue are probably one of the most influential bands of all time, because how many people started a band just copying Motley Crue? And it just went on for years and years, you know? So they were huge. But,
you know, it's weird when you think about it, like both Kiss and Motley Crue, neither one of them virtuoso bands, you know, simple heavy metal rock, but they all influence so many people.
And one thing that people always kind of say about Motley Crue, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for this, is as much of an image oriented band they are, they change their image pretty much record to record, right? And they would do that throughout their 30-year career.
Yeah, and don't you think it was a drastic change in the sound of the band from Too Fast for Love to this record? Like, almost a completely different sounding band, really.
Oh, yeah. Because Roy Thomas Baker was just like a really more of a dry production on Too Fast for Love. And then you have Tom Werman on this album. It would totally just up the game.
And you have Nikki Sixx's songwriting, which is improving, you know, album, right?
Yeah, Too Fast for Love is basically a glam album. That's really what it is. There's so many pop melodies on that record. And this is just a straight-ahead heavy metal album.
Yeah.
And so most of the really poppy melodies that you had on Too Fast for Love, they're here in parts. Like, there's still some really great choruses and stuff. But these songs are much more driven by the riffs. You know, they center around heavy metal riffs as opposed to, like, melody lines.
Definitely.
And they went with more of like the Mad Max post-apocalyptic image when on Too Fast for Love, they were just like that Sunset Strip leather and studded leather kind of, you know,
right. The
whole image. It's funny how this is why people lost their minds in the 80s, because really Motley Crue, Shout at the Devil, this is going to appeal to kids more than anything else. And yet you have these lyrics like Bastard and stuff that... So the parents, the kids are loving it, and then the parents hear these songs, and they're like, wait a minute. And so that's why they were freaking out, I guess, because totally, I mean, everything about Shout at the Devil just appealed to, you know, middle schoolers, like, so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, well, here I am, 10 years old, driving to Disney World with my family, and in my headphones, I got Vince Neil teaching me about sex ed, like, in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And I'm learning words I've never heard before. It's great.
Lee, if Vince Neil's teaching you 10 seconds to love is sex ed, I'm afraid to hear your graduate study. You know what I'm saying?
It explains a lot these days.
Yeah, Joe mentioned how Tom Werman was on board, and also the you know, Doc McGee has entered the picture now and taken over managing the band,
right?
And that guy is like the Svengali, you know, of so many bands from this era. And of course, he's been running Kiss's career for how long?
And he was partying almost just as hard as Motley was back in those days too, right?
Oh yeah. He was dealing. He got busted for bringing cocaine into the country or something, right?
Yeah, but BJ, in his defense, I think that was just to take care of Motley Crue's writer.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I mean, those boys had a voracious appetite.
Well, and a big game changer for the band was the US Festival, which actually happened before this record came out, right? But they already had the image. They had the image, and they did, they at least did Shout at the Devil and maybe Knock 'Em Dead Kid at that show, I think.
They had Looks to Kill, I think, too.
Yeah. So, and that was before the record came out, but that was a big, you know, big thing for them.
It was all teed up, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, whether you saw some of it on MTV or or wherever you heard or saw or read about it, because Back Magazine and Hit Parade and all that stuff, before this album shipped, everybody was waiting for it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Yeah, it sold 200,000 copies in the first 2 weeks. So it was, you know, right out of the gate, it was already a hit. The Ozzfest was in May, and in June of 83 is when Nikki Sixx crashed his Porsche into a telephone pole when he was driving naked, supposedly. Because I read that he got some publishing deal. He got a publishing deal, and he went right out and bought a Porsche and then crashed into a telephone pole. Jesus.
He went to a party at Roy Thomas Baker, and right. Him and Tommy were partying, and then like an orgy busted out, and he finally left, and there was two chicks that I guess saw him jump naked into his Porsche, and they started like chasing him in their cars, and they got into this this kind of car chase, which ended up in Nikki wrapping his car around a telephone pole and then just getting out and just walking down the highway buck naked until like an old farm couple picked him up and drove him to the hospital.
Jesus. But then he had a three-way with them.
Yeah. Now, well, so what is your guys' opinion? Now, my opinion or my best guess is The Dirt is like at least 75% fiction. And I don't know, of all these stories, I don't really know what to believe at this point or how much I believe any of it. So
I want to believe it all because it's so great. Right? It's so mystical. Yeah. And the one thing I'll say about that book is that it does give like all different perspectives. I love the way that it's written, where you get like Vince writes a chapter about this period, then Mick writes a little bit, then Tom Zutaw writes a bit, and then Nikki, you know. So you get kind of four or five different perspectives on one incident, and then you kind of come to your own terms about, you know, what the real truth is, maybe.
Right. I think they're so full of shit. I really do. But, you know,
I think a part of it, I think, is like it's kind of a toss up between what they wish happened and what they think happened because they just can't remember it.
Yeah. I mean, just being so and drugged out. There's a lot of embellishing going on with these stories. They just keep adding and adding to it, you know, and, you know, just more and more ridiculous.
It's all true. It's all true.
So, you know, Vince Neil had another kid in October of 83. He already had a kid like when he was 17. And then at this time, I mean, who knew back then that Vince Neil already had two kids? I don't know if anybody knew at the time.
A potent motherfucker, man. Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't believe in condoms, I guess. Yeah. In November, they went out on a 23 city tour, I guess, just on their own. But
the record came out in September, right? September 26th,
released it. Yeah.
Yes.
And so I think this is like the first time they actually played outside of California, besides a few dates up in Canada. They tried to do that Canadian tour that I think kind of ended in disaster.
Before they were like starting to do opening slots?
On Too Fast for Love era, they only played in California. They just played a bunch of shows in California, but they never even went. They never played any shows outside of California besides some Canadian shows until they went out for the Shout at the Devil tour. Yeah, then they jump on the Ozzy Bark at the Moon tour, and
they were with Kiss for a bit on Creatures of the Night.
Yeah, yeah, they did some shows with Kiss.
And there was that infamous story of them. Didn't they tag team Eric's girlfriend behind the drums like while they were playing or something?
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of story I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I don't believe. Yeah, supposedly Tommy and Nikki had sex with Eric Carr's girlfriend behind him on stage as he was playing with Kiss, which, sure. If you say so.
Yeah, but the thing about that story, true or not, is that one of the things, the problems that Kiss was having at the time was they were being out-kissed by the next generation of bands at times, whether it was Blackie Lawless with Raw Meat and that Nikki with the blood and the fire on his legs and all that. They were getting out-kissed by them. You know what I mean? Their legends were bigger than Kiss's legends at this point. So it's just typical. Mm.
Yeah, Motley Crue had the fire and the momentum. But yeah, so the stories from the Ozzy Osbourne tour are just completely insane. There's one story where Ozzy, Tommy, and Vince were drunk in the middle of a freeway, and then when the cops came, they urinated on the police car. Then they went back to the hotel, and Ozzy shit all over Tommy's hotel room bathroom and wiped the shit all over the walls.
Obviously, the ants, right? Snorting the ants.
Yeah, the line of ants.
They're all trying to, like, outgross each other, right, or something.
There's one story about Ozzy and Vince noticed a car with the key in the ignition and stole the car and then smashed the windows and ruined the upholstery.
And I like how all of these legends have like a specific name attached to them, like Thursday.
Yeah. I think the biting the head off the bat and the peeing on the Alamo, well, that Ozzy did, I think we're in the same month, whatever year that was, like 81 or whatever.
Well, you got five guys that are just, you know, on the top of their game, you know, commercially with their record selling, and they're just out of their heads, right? Ozzy's at his peak, and Motley Crue are like, you know, young kids that just, you know, hit the jackpot. And
right. And they got money coming their way and success starting to come their way. And
they're all protected,
like,
right?
Yeah.
You also have to realize, like, you know, we talked about the record being teed up by the US Festival. The kids that saw Kiss Meets the Phantom at this point were now old enough to buy stuff without their parents' permission, old enough to start going to see shows.
Hello. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So this was, you know, it was like, again, teed up. This was the year for them.
Yeah, for sure. And the whole like Road Warrior image was so perfectly timed too, because I mean, I remember, you know, I was just fascinated by, and then you had who were the wrestlers? Well, they were called the Road Warriors, right? You know, it's like that kind of theme.
Apocalyptic
was everywhere.
It was huge.
Yeah.
I love this story. They arrived at their hotel in Lakeland, Florida, and Ozzy entered the bar with a dollar bill held between the cheeks of his bare ass, and then he grabbed some old woman's bag and ran off with it and wore her dress on stage that night that he took from her bag or something. Oh, yeah, so also with the snorting the ants, he also pissed. Oh, he was wearing her dress when he snorted the ants, supposedly. And then he peed on the ground and licked up the urine off the pavement.
You know, is that the thing where then Nicky Triumph wanted to do it with his idol, so he tried to do the same thing, but before he could do it, Ozzy went down and started licking Nicky's piss up?
Yeah, right.
Jesus.
Yeah, so that was the Ozzy Motley tour.
During all this, they were still killing on stage, right? Like, I saw
that show,
and they just slayed for like 80 minutes. It was insane. Like, they had the crowd like just mesmerized by them, right? It was so great.
Yeah. Well, did they have a whole stage set? Like, yeah, kind of. Oh, yeah.
Yes, they did. Because they were the second band on the bill. It was Wasted was actually the opener on that tour on their first album.
Yeah.
I saw the Accept, which was really cool. Accept Balls to the Wall.
Yeah.
Saw them open for Kiss in like March in Toronto. And then they opened for Motley in June in Toronto.
So I guess after the Ozzy tour, they did a headline tour with Saxon and Heavy Petten opening. And then they went over to the UK and did the Monsters of Rock Festival at Donington to 60,000 people. It was during the Ozzy tour that the record went platinum, I think. You know, it all happened pretty quick for them. Because like we're saying, it was just the timing. And it was a great album, you know, with great singles. So over the course of 84, they just did a ton of touring. You know, a lot of touring. They get back home at the end of 84, December of 84. They're finally back home in California, and they're partying with their buddies in Hanoi Rocks. And we all know what happens next. Vince Neil goes to get more booze, and they were actually on their way home. I think they were almost home, I think, when the crash happened. Razzle had all the booze in his lap. They just bought like $100 worth of booze at the liquor store, and they were driving back to the party when supposedly Vince Neil hit some ice. It was December, but it was in California, so I don't.
So does that mean Razzle probably wasn't wearing a seatbelt then either, right? If he had his lap full with bottles of alcohol,
yeah, probably not.
Right.
And the two people in the car they hit both ended up with brain damage and like serious issues, like lifelong injuries. Out of this too, which Vince Neil probably ended up paying a good portion of his royalties to those people. He's probably still paying them.
I think I read he's still paying them off, like, regularly. Yeah. Which you should.
Oh yeah, exactly. Should. But you know, yeah, you look at a guy like Vince Neil who has all this success and then just squanders it all with his stupidity, you know.
Well, I think that was one of the things they were saying, like, what would be better, to put this guy in jail for like 5 years, or why don't we just let him out and we'll let him make some money because he's a superstar and he can pay these people, you know, a good chunk of change and he'll be able to do it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they made so much money, you know, all the way through the 80s into the 90s, you know, they made a shitload of money. That's for sure. And squandered a lot of it too, except for Mick. Yeah. Mick Mars probably put it all away.
Oh, he was the oldest one. He was probably smart enough to do that and not party too much.
But he was guilty of having some bad relationships and some bad marriage choices, which kind of drained him in that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there goes half of this and half of that. Yeah. Well, yeah, they all have been married how many times? I mean, Tommy Lee got married back in 84. He married his girlfriend named Candace, which I don't think that lasted long, but, you know, because soon after he's married to Heather Locklear, right? So... yeah, and how many times has Nikki been married? 3 or 4, right? Nikki married the girl from the Love in the Elevator, Love in an Elevator video, right? I know he married her.
Brandy something. She was a penthouse chick.
Right, right. Yeah, and Tommy married Pamela Anderson after a week or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So
he's still paying for that one.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, I don't know. You guys have anything else to say about the record in general or this time for Motley Crue?
Well, we definitely haven't started talking about the record. We've talked about a lot of debauchery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll go track by track. But yeah, I mean,
this is one of my favorite records of all time. This is a Desert Island record for me, too. I would, you know, this is probably one of my, dare I say, top 10 records of all time, any band, I think. You know, this, a lot of it has to do with nostalgia and the impact it makes on a 10-year-old kid, you know, but that still counts. And I'll always love this record.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's a seminal album from the 80s, like, metal scene, if you want to call it metal even. But at the time, it was metal.
Oh, it's metal. You know? Yeah.
And it's certainly, like you said, BJ, it certainly influenced so many other bands. And as Ken said, it was a total game changer. You know, I agree with all of that.
Yeah, it was the 80s. It was the, you know, there's so many elements of what a certain segment of like kids were into in the 80s that's wrapped up in this music, but it's all the imagery and, you know, and then they milk the Satanism and everything. So,
yeah, I didn't know what it meant, but a pentagram was really cool to write on your school notebook, you know?
Yeah, right. It wasn't it Shout with the Devil, and then somebody suggested that they change it to Shout at the Devil.
That's a Toronto New Music interview with Daniel Richler, and like he's calling them out on their Satanism, and like Vince is like, but it's, or Nikki's like, it's Shout at the Devil, not Shout with the Devil. And then Vince is like if you stand actually in the middle of the pentagram, that's actually a really safe place to be.
Right. I remember that.
Perhaps Razzle Dingley should have been in the center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wearing seatbelt.
I always thought it was kind of, you know, a pussy move on Nikki Sixx's part to, you know, claim to be this big Satanist guy and then change, right? But did you guys hear the story about what Tom Zutaut had to say about it? He signed the band to Elektra Records, and he told the author of Crue's biography that Nikki Sixx was exploring Satanism at the time and wanted to call the song in the album Shout with the Devil. Tom also claims that he saw a knife and fork rise off the table stick into the ceiling.
That's from the dirt. That's a big cry. See, Tom Zutaut is one of the people in the book that's just completely full of shit. We talked about that on the Too Fast for Love episode, because Motley Crue had a manager named Alan Kaufman, and they claimed that Alan Kaufman ripped them off, but in actuality, they ripped Alan Kaufman off, and Tom Zutaut, like, undercut him, and then, you know, guess who talks the most shit about Alan Kaufman in the book? It's Tom Zutaut, but he's the guy that undercut that guy, you know, and stole the band away to Elektra Records and then takes all the credit, even though this guy, Alan Coffman, invested like 500 grand in the band, like all their early stage, you know, they had a big stage set even when they were just playing the clubs. And yeah. that guy paid for all yeah. of that. And then they just dumped him, and he really never even, you know, made any of his money back off of it. So it's a rare case of the guy, the manager guy, got screwed instead of the other way around. No. But Zutaut is a douche. I think that's pretty indisputable.
Well, I'm just reading Lita Ford's book right now, and I just reread the chapter about this era before we recorded here, and she kind of corroborates that, you know, they were dabbling in, like, reading, like, books of the occult, and they got, like, spell books. And she said, like, shit was levitating in the apartment and stuff like that, and they had a big pentagram over their couch, and she said it was freaky, so...
They were all so high that they were, it was just fishing.
I'm confident in saying that nothing was levitating. That's just me.
When you take enough drugs, everything is levitating. Anyway, here's the quote.
Yeah, what was levitating was the level of drugs in their system. That's what was levitating.
Right. Yeah, I think so much of that is just... It's all PR spin, you know.
It's fun,
cause
though, yeah.
Because it sounds cool and sells records, you know? Yeah. I mean.
And then, like, guys like us talk about it 40 years later.
Yeah.
Still, well, yeah, that's totally what they were. That's the whole, that's what, you know, the PMRC didn't understand, is that the whole point of a lot of this was to get the attention, to get the outrage, yeah. to get the press to sell the records, you know? That was the point.
Yeah.
Like, so. Spinal Tap, man. Smell the glove. It's like...
Well, listen to this, okay? Zutaut claims he saw a knife and fork rise off the table and stick into the ceiling. He writes, "I looked at Nikki and I freaked out." He says, "Nikki, there's no more Shout with the Devil. If you keep shouting with the devil, you're going to get killed." Does anyone believe that that actually happened?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. No, I don't believe that forks levitate. I don't.
You don't believe in spooks, BJ? I believe in spooks, man.
He also goes on to say, "I truly believe that Nikki had unknowingly tapped into something yeah. evil.
It's
something more dangerous than he could control that was on the verge of seriously hurting him. Nikki must have realized the same thing because he decided on his own to change the album title to Shout at the Devil."
Yeah, sure. I hate Zutaut's parts in the book because he's such a douche and he's so full of shit. And yeah. he's so self-congratulatory. You know, and then he ends up being the guy that signs Guns N' Roses, too, so he could really pat himself on the back, you know?
He's full of himself is what he's full
yeah.
of.
But. Yeah.
Yeah, but those are two good signs. I mean, you got to give yeah. it to him.
All right, well, I guess we can jump into the track by track for the record.
All right, well, BJ, just before we get started, I just wanted to say that just like the record, how they recorded it for this podcast. I prepared for this podcast with Foster's Lager, Budweiser, Bombay Gin, lots of Jack Daniels, Kahlua and Brandy Quackers and Krell and Wild Women.
All right, Lee's ready to go. He's ready to shout with the devil.
No, at the devil.
Well, Lee, do you have a fork handy? You got a fork handy? Let us know if it levitates.
All the cutlery is secured.
What the fork? Yeah. You know, Tom Werman produced this record, and I actually talked to Tom Werman a couple weeks ago, and my plan was to, like, edit parts into these different episodes from my conversation with him, but I think instead I'm just going to release it as, like, a bonus episode, maybe after the Girls episode, because I talked to Tom Werman about the records that he produced, but... I think it would be too difficult to try to just stick parts like I was planning on, like editing them parts into the episodes. I think I'll just release it as a separate episode. But he was at Elektra. He got hired as the head of A&R at Elektra right around the time they got signed, but he had a disagreement like really quick with the other guy that was running the label, and he quit Elektra pretty soon after, like before this album was made, but he stayed on as the producer, even though he had left the label, I think is how it worked. But, you know, poor Tom Werman gets so much shit from these bands that he worked with that he made these huge selling albums with.
Yeah, come on.
And
he went from this to like Twisted Sister, Stay Hungry, right? He did he did Open Up and Say Ah too, didn't he?
Yeah, he gets shit from Cheap Trick, Twisted Sister, and Motley Crue, who all talk shit about him, and I don't get it.
For as much as any band might talk about him, I think that he kind of set the sound for what a metal record would sound like in that like 82 to 87 era. You know what I mean? Like everybody tried to emulate that sound.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So in the beginning is kind of this pointless intro. This is just a skip for me. And this is the...
It's a setup.
Do you know who is actually Alistair Fiend on this track?
I do, yeah. That's with the engineer.
Yeah, right? It's the engineer. Jeff, just because he had a British accent.
And my whole childhood, like when I was reading the credits, like the credits say like music, Jeff Workman, narration, Nikki Six. So I always thought that meant Nikki was doing the voice, right? Because it's not lyrics, Nikki Six, but Nikki wrote it. But Jeff Workman is speaking it, right?
Well, see, I love this too because I'm going to echo Ken here. Like the first time I heard this, it's like, oh, this is Bowie, Diamond Dogs, because that was my favorite David Bowie album point. So I'm like, this is so awesome. I love that.
Yeah, BJ, you should play a bit of Future Legend, the first track off Diamond Dogs right now, so that people can compare the two.
Yeah.
And in the death, as the last few corpses lay rotting on the slimy thoroughfare, the shutters lifted an ancient temperance building high on Boches Hill, and red mutant eyes gazed down on Hunger City.
Now, this is not an homage. It's a complete lift.
Totally. Because the very end line where the climax and the keyboards are building up, and he's like, so come now, children of the beast, be strong and shout at the devil, and your adrenaline's pumping, and then there's that pause, and then down, down, down.
Exactly. Goosebumps,
right? Drop.
It's killer. And when they played it live, like that was the opening of the live show.
It feels like a last-minute addition to me. Like, oh, let's scribble this out and throw this on the beginning. It's over a minute long. I mean, come on. But it takes us into Shout at the Devil, which I absolutely love. Great riffs. The staccato delivery on the verse is insane, but somehow it works. But it's just nuts. But I love like the way the riff stops and there's like the cymbal, you know. I love Schultz. That. It's really cool the way it's constructed. And then huge chorus, you know, so great song.
Just imagine if you could have heard a fork drop, you know.
This is a song that, like, you know, Vince's snotty vocals just really work well, right? The delivery is perfect. Like, he's like one of the only guys that could sing something like this, right? Like, you get a guy that can sing too well, like Rob Halford, Bruce Dickinson, or something like that, they're not going to be able to deliver it like that, right? You know, it's just killer drumming by Tommy Lee on this. All those cymbal chokes and the hi-hat, like in the breaks of the verses, you know, it's just so great. Love it.
That is really what makes the song is that interplay with Tommy Lee, right? And boy, he's got a heavy foot on this album, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
The outro where they bring the intro lick back, Mick comes back in with that. And then Tommy goes into this double kick thing, right? Just on the last 16 bars or something like that. Like, oh, that always gave me goosebumps as a kid. Love that.
Goosebumps as you were walking through Disneyland with a fucking Mickey Mouse. And your Walkman turned up to 11.
Well, yeah, another funny story too is like in this would have been grade 3, grade 4 maybe, and then like in June we had like the class would go on this little walk to the conservation area for like a nice summer day, right, last day of school kind of thing, and I was in charge of bringing the music, so so I brought my boombox, and this is the only tape I brought. So the whole time we were walking to the park, and we were just cranking Shout at the Devil, right, with all these like 9, 10-year-olds walking to the park in the summer.
it's the way this song is constructed. There's no other song like this ever, especially the verse, the way the riff cuts off and how many words are fit into those verses. it's kind of insane the way the verse is constructed of this song, but it really works. It's pretty awesome. But you know, I think probably almost every line of the verse is a different take by Vince. You know, he did not sing any of this straight through.
No,
that's for sure.
He couldn't. I mean, now when if you go on YouTube and see a performance of Vince Neil, he's lucky to say four words out of an entire sentence.
Yeah, even at the US Festival, the performance of this song, he does not fit all the words in. Not even close.
No, I can't. He's too fast.
Probably doesn't know him yet, too.
Yeah.
And I never knew that one lyric was laugh. Be strong, laugh. And I never knew it was like, be strong, laugh, and show to the devil.
Right. So is Shout at the Devil goes right into Looks That Kill, which, you know, first single, amazing riffs, very melodic. Yeah. This is great songwriting, you know, just great.
Oh, yeah.
This is a great song. This is probably my favorite Motley Crue song of all time. That killer riff. Like this record is when I was starting to learn guitar too, right? So that riff, that always reminded me of Cold Gin. Right, same notes.
Exactly.
Oh wow.
Right, so
sped
like
up.
Yeah, sped up a little bit, and just a little, the phrasing's a little different too, right? So you can see a little bit of the influence of Kiss there. Although I do assume that was a Nicky riff, because Mick is notorious for saying that he hates Kiss, you know.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, this is most of these songs are just written by Nicky.
Well, it's a perfect mix. If it's the perfect sum of all four parts, where you have Mick and Tommy, who are the musicians in the band, like really carrying the music stuff. You have Nicky, who's like the soul and the songwriter, and you have like just Vince, that kind of snotty front man that you kind of need, right?
So Mick is a ridiculous character to end up in this band, but you know what he brings to the band is awesome, because he, you know, he was probably the kind of guy who could play almost anything. I mean, he never, you know, was in a hard rock or heavy metal band really before Motley Crue, I don't think, but he, you know, he was
like
able
Southern rock blues bands he was in.
But he was able to bring his own interpretation, and he has an awesome guitar tone that is just, you know. And so, yeah, what he does with these heavy metal riffs is awesome.
BJ, I want you to think about what you were, you know, you just said that he was such a crazy character to be in this band. Everyone that is in this band is so over the top and insane. They're all walking cartoons in a way when you think about it.
Yeah, but he's like 10 years older than the other guys. And he is like this little like troll guy. I mean, he's just like the strangest fucking guy. And then he ends up with these young party animal nutcases. You know, it's a very weird combination.
Perfect. Well, you need that though. If it was all four crazy party animal guys, it would be a little off balance. You need Mick to kind of, you know, balance it out a little bit.
Yeah.
But shit, there's no way I would have let Vince Neil be the singer. There's no way. If I was in this band, I would have threw his ass out. The guy, for whatever he brings to the table, if I were in the studio with him, I'd go, is this what we want to sound like?
But Ken, Vince brings the chicks to the table.
Yeah, I did.
That's what they needed, man. That's what they needed.
I know.
I think Vince really works on these early albums. It really works for some reason.
Yeah,
he does.
And, you know, one thing Tom Werman said is that Vince Neil always, he did his work. He wasn't lazy. You know, he wasn't a fuck up. He would go into the studio and put the time in, you know, to get the tracks. So,
like, you talk about his delivery in Shout at the Devil, right?
It's nuts.
I don't know. It is. It's absolutely crazy. I don't know if I would have, like, kept any of those takes. And that just shows why I've never, you know, sold a platinum album, right? But,
well, I love it, though.
I do, too.
Yeah.
I do, too.
It's different, which, you know.
Well, it's that's, like, Lee said, it's that snotty punk attitude that he brings that makes it unique. And it, like, as you were saying, totally fits these early albums. It can kind of wear on the later stuff, but for these records, it just, it's exactly what you need. It makes it work.
Well, look at the way Steven Piercy sings. But, you know, Out of the Cellar is an amazing record. But his vocals are ridiculous, you know. Yeah. So.
But that, I mean,
it's just a style. It's a style.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's why the attitude was as much as the talent or lack thereof of talent. David Lee Roth's not a great singer, but it's everything else. It's the personality and the attitude that he brings to delivering those lines that make them what they are.
Right.
You know.
And before we get off Looks the Kill, I just wanted to make a comment on Nicky's bass playing, which kind of gets dogged a lot that he's not a very good bass player. But I think his bass playing is pretty killer on this track. The way he's riding heavy on the eighth notes, you know, during the verses and the riff. And then, like, in the chorus, he goes into, like, a melody part where he's doing the doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, you know, those interludes and stuff like that. And then, like, he goes back and forth into this, like, kind of head-banging eighth notes on the bass, which I think is really cool, you know.
Lee, let me ask you a question. There are times in this song where it almost sounds disorienting, where it almost seems like Tommy Lee's the one that's sliding a bit off, but he's not. It's rock solid. But it's something that is going on with the guitar. You know, like when they do that like flange kind of thing where it just drifts off. You almost feel like you're on a tilt-a-whirl or something while the song's playing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Does anyone else pick up on that?
Or is that breakdown section, you know, the do-do-do-do-do. It's just kind of that uneven feel to it.
Well, even when there's that, but then even when they just let the guitar ring out right at the beginning, it just seems like it could go off the rails of the Crazy Train to go.
Well, that's the band. That's those three guys that have been jamming together for a couple of years, right? And they got a sound down. And, you know, Mick and Tommy are kind of joined at the hip. You know, I always like to say the drummer and the bass player are kind of the two guys that are joined at the hip. But certain bands, it's like, you know, Mick and Tommy are the band. Or it's like Keith and Pete from The Who are kind of the musical portions. You know, it's like Keith and Charlie from The Stones rather than that bass player-drummer relationship.
Could you guys imagine Cinderella covering this?
Sure.
I mean,
Night Songs is very, you know, that's very influenced by this kind of thing. Yeah.
To me, it could be on either album. You know, it just shows how quick this set a standard.
Yeah. There's a bit of a violent edge, I think, to this that Tom doesn't have, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Looks That Kill is one of their most impressive songs. It's pretty intricately arranged, and it's like there's multiple great riffs, and the vocal melody is great. So it's just, this is a really, really well written song. It's very inspired, you know.
It's got your obligatory heavy metal frontman scream. You know, Vince lets off a pretty good scream there. You know,
killer guitar solo.
Yeah.
Well, and Lee, supposedly Nicky wrote it about Lita Ford, so. That would make you like it even more, I think.
It's hot.
Hot. Hot.
She's razor sharp. She is.
And if she don't get her way, she'll slice you apart.
So moving on to the next song, Bastard, this has kind of always been my favorite because it's a great up-tempo metal song, the fucking lyrics. Now, one thing said that this was about Alan Kaufman, their previous manager, who actually didn't rip them off. I remember there was this guy, John Ankerberg, who was like a televangelist guy, and he had this series of shows that were about the dangers of rock and roll that me and my friend would watch and laugh our asses off at, you know, back in the 80s, and he really hated this song.
him and Bob Larson at the same time. And the Peters brothers. Those were, this was a big thing happening at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Use Sape to sell your records, kids.
Well, John Ankerberg even had an episode about so-called safe music, like New Kids on the Block, and how that was satanic. Oh, God.
Right. Well, it's just a slide, BJ. The next thing you know, you're, hanging tough, and the next thing you know, you're levitating silverware in the kitchen. It's got to start somewhere. That's right. But let's take a look at the influences so far. We've got David Bowie on track one. We've got the Cold Gin riff kind of a thing. We've got Aerosmith being named, kind of song checked. And so just keep an eye, because we're just going to see another Kiss thing on the next track.
I do like the, the great drum fill intro that kind of just fades in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then similarly, it ends the same way with like a Tommy's like choking the cymbal. And then it kind of fades out.
Yeah, this song is just a quick blast. It just slams in. And it's like, high speed the whole way through, and then it ends, and it's just kind of perfect.
And this song's famous for being one of the Filthy 15, right? This is one of the songs Tipper Gore found extremely offensive, right?
Yeah.
She cited this being
stick in my knife, pull out his life, or whatever they say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the part they didn't like.
It's the nightmare of every kid back then, if your mom would read the actual lyric.
Consider that bastard dead. Is this really what you want to be putting into your head, Jimmy?
I love Vince's whoa-hoes on the chorus, right? Tommy goes into this, like, he plays eighth notes on the bass drum, and Vince is like, whoa-ho, bastard. Make it quick, off his head.
Yeah, and I love the gang vocals on this record. The gang vocals are great.
Yeah.
Every chorus has got a big gang vocal.
Yeah.
When you're in a crowd of like 10,000 people in Toronto, and they're all like up this near screaming like bastard, it's so great.
Yeah,
oh,
but
man. I wish I had a time machine.
So the bad. Only problem is that Canadians are so damn polite they have to apologize after singing that. So, bastard, sorry, eh?
Bastard is such a cool word. It's like a slight curse word. Like, it's not like fuck or shit. It's like bastard, son of a bitch. It's one of those like peripheral swear words, right?
Hoser. Consider that hoser dead.
That'd be the cleaned out version that would air on Much Music.
Can cut it up.
All right, so for me, this is where side one should end.
Yeah.
Because the rest of side one is pointless.
How dare you?
You've just had three like killing like over your head rockers.
Great
now
songs.
You're gonna have like a little bit of an interlude here.
Blah blah.
Also a staple of the records at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that little guitar interlude.
Yeah, little Mick Mars acoustic guitar, right?
Yeah, and then it's obvious why they covered Helter Skelter, for the taboo nature of the song, the connection to Charlie Manson and everything, but this
yeah,
is
but
not a good cover.
Over, are
I
we
disagree.
Skipping over Love God this. Bless the Children of the Beast?
Yeah,
we
just talked
them?
About that blah. I thought we talked about it enough.
Yeah, it's great. It's like rock bottom, right?
It's exactly rock bottom.
Yeah, which it's I would never I cut out of every mixtape. Yeah, it's exactly like that boring rock bottom, ridiculous filler.
got time for these setups, man.
That Rock Bottom intro is the most literal definition of filler. That's exactly why it's there, because the record was so short and they were just filling time.
Lee, you're a guitar player. How similar are is God Bless the Children of the Beast and the beginning of Rock Bottom?
It's similar.
Yeah. That Rock Bottom was one of the first things I learned to play on guitar. It's similar.
Yeah. So you really don't like the cover of Helter Skelter, Brian?
No, it's terrible.
I love it. I think it's great.
I like it. This was the first song I heard by Motley Crue, was Helter Skelter. That was the first thing I heard by them.
Really?
Yep. It was the second promotional single released off the album. That was like the first track I actually ever got a chance to hear by them.
Motley Crue, they have some of the worst covers ever. They have just terrible, terrible covers.
Oh, I'll take this over Smoking in the Boys Room, though. I'll tell you that.
Every day of the week.
Jailhouse Rock is a fucking nightmare. Anarchy in the UK. I mean, they are just...
Anarchy. I like Anarchy.
They should not do cover songs. Vince should not sing covers.
I think this
Vince
is
can
their
sing
best
Motley Crue
song.
Songs.
What about Tonight? That's a good one. Tonight.
Oh, it's horrible. Their version of Tonight is a complete disaster.
I think this is their best cover.
This is great.
That's not saying much.
Yeah.
I prefer this.
I'm going to agree with Ken.
This is their best turd?
Here's the weird thing about this song is no matter how good or bad it is, it just makes the Beatles version all that much cooler. For coming when it did and being as heavy as it did, and you know, you really can't heavy that up anymore, because if you do, you kind of lose something that made it great. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think Motley brought a heavy edge to it that the Beatles couldn't. The Beatles, when you hear their version, it just kind of sounds like a sloppy jam, whereas Motley sounds like a precise knife, like cutting your head off with the Mick Mars guitar tone and the way Tommy is just destroying those drums, you know, and I think it's a killer.
Yeah, version. But it's Vince singing it is the problem.
Yeah, it fits with all the other songs in the record. It sounds like Motley.
Yeah.
Right? It sounds like Sleaze Rock from Sunset Strips.
Right.
It sounds like they're drunk and they just got laid.
So, Brian, the panel goes against you. Mileage will vary. We all outvote you. Fuck off, bastard.
Well, yeah, because to me, it was like kind of thing where I heard this, like, wow, this is what they can do with a Beatles tune. It's 17, mind you. What I can't wait to hear what their original stuff sounds like, you know. Because like, they made this Beatles tune all heavy, and I'm like, at the time, I let it, maybe not so crazy about it now, but I was waiting for their
I was waiting for their tricked out version of Twist and Shout. That's a joke.
All right, so I guess we're flipping the record over, and Side 2 kicks off with Red Hot, which was always one of my least favorites on the album, just because it's...
Oh,
it's,
you're it's, killing me. It's one of my favorite tracks on the album.
I mean,
man,
it's not nearly as good as those first three songs on Side 1.
It's up there.
It's a cool metal song, but it's very generic and just, like, not a great chorus. So, for me...
To me, this was... It was just laying around or something, because this is not their A stuff. I'm telling you.
I mean, this is no Looks That Kill, man. Come on.
Right. And then there's that weird guitar thing where it sounds like he gives up interest in playing it at some point. You know, it's not very rhythmic. This is the throwaway on the album.
I couldn't disagree more with you guys.
Me either.
This song is the perfect opener for Side 2 out of all the songs. This is what you're definitely going to open up Side 2 with. You get Tommy and Nicky kicking that groove off right off the top, and then Mick comes in with this killer guitar slide, just barely rips your head off, right? And then Vince comes in with the sleazy, gang lyrics about, like, you know, being a posse, being a gang out on the street, and, you know, ready to take down everything in your way. It's so great.
Now, I don't know if this is true or not. Well, was this not used as a commercial for the Red Hot candy?
No, it wasn't, Ken.
Oh, well, gee, I didn't know. Just imagine that. Vince Neil and holding up a thing of Red Hots. That would be great.
Red Hot! Red Hot!
I like the song. I enjoy the song, but it's, you know, it's a letdown compared to those first three songs on side one, I would say.
Yeah, but you don't need to compare everything to each other, man. It's all good, right?
Yeah.
Like, the one thing I love about Motley Crue and this configuration of a band, and I just did a podcast, a sidecast about this, which is bands that are vocals, guitar, bass, and drums, right? I love when there's a guitar solo and the rhythm guitar drops out and it's just bass and drums underneath, right? And a lot of this record, you know, mixed doubling a rhythm guitar under his solos, but on this one in particular for his solos, it's just empty under there, right? And I just love that. Because you hear the bass and the drums a little bit better.
Yeah, it where it falls flat is Vince Neil to me. That's that, you know. But it would have made a great Red Hot candy commercial. So,
well, if you compare it to the next song, I mean, the next song, "Too Young to Fall in Love," is just so much more creative. And you know, Red Hot, like I said, it's kind of generic. It doesn't feel like a Motley Crue song. It feels like it could have been a thousand bands. "Too Young to Fall in Love" is much more of, you know, what "Shout at the Devil" is in terms of as being unique as Motley Crue. You know, I mean,
well, that's why it was a single. This is a great song.
Yeah, it's spectacular songwriting.
But Red Hot serves its purpose, and what it's supposed to do is get your blood pumping again and get you amped up for the second song.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you want.
It doesn't have, you know.
Yeah, it's true. First song on side two, you want it to be like a. Yeah, straight ahead rocker like that. That's true.
Yeah, Tommy Lee on those double bass drums, man.
And then "Too Young to Fall in Love" comes in and goes, "Oh shit."
Tommy goes from this like overkill like heavy metal drumming to this like slinky like right in the pocket kind of slow groove, right? Oh,
yeah.
So great right off the top, and then Mick comes in with that that sexy guitar riff.
Yeah, doesn't it seem like Nikki Sixx had like this burst of creativity that he never had this again? You know, where did these songs come from? As in terms of songwriting, he never even got close to this kind of quality.
Well, he was still young and he just started taking all those drugs and alcohol, you know? I mean, come on. They hadn't worn their effects on him yet.
Yeah. But, you know, you'll have an album like this where the songs are so good and it all works together and it was all written. You could tell that it was all written, like, fast and all at the same time. And it's just like this burst, you know, that it sometimes it just happens. You know, there's just this magical thing that have. There's certain albums like this where you just feel it, you know, that it just all came together.
Well, he was definitely driven. Nikki Sixx, the first 2 or 3 years of that band, he was definitely a driven guy in his early 20s looking to shooting for the stars, you know.
He was hungry.
Yeah, yeah. You can hear it. I love the guitar riff, the descending minor guitar riff that goes along with the chorus there by Mick. And his guitar solo on this. Mick's really got some great singable guitar solos. This is definitely one, right?
Yeah, it is interesting that the two singles off this album are like by far the most well-written songs, for sure. You know, "Looks That Kill" and this are like the ones that have the greatest arrangements and like are, you know, the most creative and just cool.
And don't forget, this is the love power ballad song off the album. I mean, the closest that they could get to it, right?
Well, there's one coming up, maybe. But yeah, I get what you're saying. You could.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, in terms of what did I miss?
Wait a second. Hang on that for a moment. Lee on a cruise ship with some girl slow dancing too young to fall in love.
Yeah, for sure. Doing that thing where I got my hand on her ass and she's got her hand around my shoulders and we're just walking in a slow circle, you know, going around and around.
Not a woman, but a whore.
Yeah.
I can just taste the hate.
You're killing me. Your love's a guillotine. Now I'm killing you. Watch your face turning blue.
You gotta do an acoustic version, like a Gordon Lightfoot take on it or something. But I remember when this was a big video.
Yeah.
You know, on Friday night videos. Oh,
we gotta talk about the video for sure.
It was a lot of fun, but I want to take a second and talk about the image. I was like 20 years old when this album came out, and I was looking at these guys. Are these guys going to replace Kiss in my mind? You know what I mean? Are these guys going to be the next thing for me?
Yeah, that's what's different about Motley Crue than Kiss is that, you know, Kiss, so much of Kiss's success was based on the visuals, but Motley Crue had MTV that Kiss in their heyday didn't have. So Motley Crue could take it even further with the visual aspects and the image, you know, as part of their, as a big part of their success. You know, a big reason they sold so many albums was those videos.
There is a picture somewhere of Ken Mills with two stripes on his on his cheek.
Mr. Monster? Was Mr. Monster influenced by Motley Crue?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great song. I don't know what else to say. The video is...
That's killer, man. Come on.
Now, which video came first? Too Young to Fall in Love or All Hell's Breaking Loose? Like, they're both kind of like the band fighting in the horror, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I believe Too Young to Fall in Love came first.
Yeah.
I think it was the other way around, actually.
Really?
Let me find out. Let's see. Because Too Young to Fall in Love didn't come out until April of 84.
Ah.
Yeah,
I want to say All Hell's Breaking Loose was early 84 or late 83.
I love that visual at the very end of the video where they're all standing there against the rice paper background and they hit the gong and they all like put the horns in the air and there's that kind of slow freeze frame. Oh, it's so heavy.
And aren't there like kung fu sound effects and stuff in the video?
Yes. Yeah, with the fights, yeah.
Look, you can make fun of Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, but this is like a 3-minute version of... They're, you know, doing Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. You've got the you could almost cut it with the Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park where they're fighting the samurai guys and stuff like that. That would be a fun thing for someone to do.
Kiss was first February 6, 1984.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Hadn't thought about that.
But when Tommy Lee spits the rice out and throws it back at the person.
That's great. He does that little do-si-do and he hits the guy with a bag of rice or something like that.
Yeah. But they all do that like thing that we would later see in Michael Keaton's Batman movie where he just steps out and goes quack, you know, the backward punch where you can't see the person coming up behind you, but they do it.
Yeah, right.
That doesn't work in real life, kids. Don't ever try that in a real fight. You'll get your ass kicked. And you deserve to have your ass kicked if you try it.
All right, so the next song on the record is Knock 'Em Dead Kid, which I've always liked this song, but it's pretty simple and dumb, you know? It's like...
Wait a second. Remember that you're talking about an album called Shout at the Devil before you say anything's dumb. I mean, seriously, there's not much brain work going on here.
That's why we love it, man. That's why we love
it. Exactly. You can turn your mind off on this. And I've got to tell you guys something. I almost didn't do this show because of how much Vince Neil has not learned in life, right? What has happened, the tragedies and the things that he continues to do.
Like what? Give me some examples.
Well,
did you see that clip with him and Nicolas Cage from a couple of years ago?
Yeah, but what did he do? What did he do? He was drunk in public. Like, that's nothing new.
No, no, no. He assaulted a sex worker, grabbing her by the throat and throwing her against the wall in 2003. On April 9th, 2004, he pleaded no contest to battery charge, was sentenced to 30 days and 60 days anger management. He was fined $1,000 plus court fees of $132. And then he came on TV and said that he was being profiled because of what happened. You're continued to drive, you know, driving drunk and all that stuff. It's not this. He's got a career of this. You know, it's not just a one time.
When was
thing.
He driving drunk? Was he arrested for driving drunk?
In 2007, Neil was arrested for suspicion of DUI in Las Vegas after police spotted him making some erratic moves in his Ferrari.
That's suspicion, though. It's not. He wasn't arrested for.
He later worked out a deal with prosecutors where he pleaded guilty to reckless driving in exchange for them dropping the DUI charge.
Some autographs and shit too, probably.
Yeah. On June 2010, Neil was arrested on suspicion of drunk driving again in Las Vegas after allegedly smashing a fan's camera, and was released on $2,000 bond. On 2011, he pled guilty to drunk driving, was sentenced to 15 days in the Clark County Jail, 15 days under house arrest. On 2011, Neil was charged with battery and disorderly conduct after an altercation with his ex-girlfriend, Alicia Jacobs. They pled not guilty on his behalf. It was ordered to stay away from Jacobs.
Whatever. I don't judge people, man. Like, I just like his music. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't give a fuck, really. Like,
I know, but I'm talking about me, okay? Right. Mileage Berry. It's been hard to be a Motley Crue fan.
Yeah, well, Lee, on a scale of 1 to 10, how talented is Vince Neil?
Yeah, but that's not why I like him. I like him because I like him.
And he's dumb as a rock, and he's a professional fuck up, you know, his entire fucking life.
Well, he's a millionaire, so that's not, he hasn't fucked up too much, you know? Like, he's right. Living his life.
He's a millionaire because Nikki Sixx wrote these songs, and he, you know, constructed them line word by word in the studio, and then could never do it live.
Well, then when Nikki tried to replace Vince Neil? Like,
well, yeah, no, it was never. It's not going to be the same without him. That's true. I mean, Motley Crue is Vince Neil on vocals.
Yeah, and that's his value, right? He brings something to the pie, right? Like, I like him. That's why he's my favorite Motley Crue singer.
Yeah, but that's the same thing as like the logo and the original lineup, right? It's always going to be the love that you have for that first thing, right? And no matter how you change it, it's never going to be the same again. You can only hope to have the illusion of it, right?
Not always. But there's situations where I like a band later on in life, you know? Like,
yeah, but it's very rare that can happen, you know?
Yeah.
Like I think ZZ Top's really the only band that can kind of pull that off, right? You know what I'm saying? It's just that's been, like, consistent, you know what I mean? But the reason I bring up all of this stuff about Vince Neil is not to slag this album, because it stands on its own, right? I mean, the great thing that I've actually stopped listening to Motley Crue as a result of this continued not learning on his part, because I would like him to realize that, like, a lot of things that he does damages some people's lives, you know what I mean? And it's not, like, for example, once someone dies, it's not that fun anymore, right? And so it's been tough to be a Motley Crue fan. But having said that, this week, taking this opportunity to just listen to this album away from all that bullshit, it took me back to the fun of it, you know, to the ridiculous, over-the-top, absurd lyrics, and just an album that I really enjoyed at the time. So I want to thank you guys for letting me do that, but I cannot totally step it away from the real life stuff. It's kind of like Michael Jackson, right? I don't know what happened there, but it makes it hard. Like, every once in a while, you'll like hear, you know, Billie Jean, right? And you'll go, damn, that's a cool song. And then you go, yeah, but what happened there? So sometimes it's hard to divorce real things. Or,
well, everybody's got to make their own decision, right? What they're comfortable with.
Exactly.
You got to be
how they can handle their art, right? Like, how many of these guys that make great art are just, you know, weird human beings, and it's, how do you deal with that, you know?
How many times is Tommy Lieben accused of punching a woman, you know?
Right.
Numerous times.
Yes. So you got to figure out how or if you can separate the art from the artist.
Right. And this week, because of this podcast, I was able to enjoy this album in a way I haven't enjoyed it in probably about 10 years. So,
well, the key word you said is fun. And that's what this album is and was, is just a lot of fun. And that's what the PMRC could not grasp or get a handle on, is that it's just fun. It's not serious and it's not satanic. You know, everybody was, you know, the kids liked it because it was fun and cool. And that's what, you know, that's all it was. So.
But getting back to the actual album and the life lessons that it taught Lee McCormick, I want to know how 10 Seconds to Love helped Lee's love life out. I mean,
well, we're not... well, you could fit more in if it's only 10 seconds.
Well, no, that's true, though, because there's 10
it's
seconds.
It's a big cruise ship and there's a lot of ladies.
If you analyze the lyrics on this, and this is the one. This is the one song where Vince Neil gets a writing credit, I think, on the record, right? Where he some of the lyrics to this. Right?
No, there's two.
Yeah, there's two? Some highbrow lyrics from Vince.
What I've taken from the lyrics on this is that you know, this is you know, beautiful lyrics about those final 10 seconds before climax. Right? Like, because he's saying, like, touch my gun but don't pull the trigger. Like, he's saying, like, not yet, right? Like, he's like, let's make history in the elevator, you know, shine my pistol, here I come, just 10 seconds more. So he's actually like, so he's actually telling her, like, 10 seconds, get ready, because here it comes, right? So
10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
So I learned that at like 19 years old. And then when we get to verse 2, he's talking about like, hey, bring a girlfriend if you want. Maybe bring two, because he's got a camera, right? He's going to make a star. So that's where I'm learning a little bit about like you know, like threesomes and foursomes and some exhibitions.
And Morrisons.
And stuff, yeah. Right?
Yeah, well, you know, I said Knock 'Em Dead Kid was simple and dumb. This song is simpler and dumber. But I like it, though. I've always liked it. But, you know, this song is the longest song on the album, and it should have been the shortest. So
it does have a bit of fatigue. It's weird that a song that's...
It goes on and on.
About 10 seconds goes on longer than it should, yeah.
It's about the... But, yeah, working up to the climax.
10
right?
seconds too long.
10 seconds too long. If it were only 10 seconds too long.
Yeah, every time they say 10 seconds too long, that adds another 10 seconds too long it is.
I love the intro, though. It's a real original intro. It's a real quick pickup with just that guitar riff, and then Vince is right in bar one there with the first verse, right?
Yeah,
I think it's these two songs being right in a row, and they're kind of similar, and I always liked them, but if you like look at them objectively, they're pretty fucking stupid, you know?
Yeah, but you don't look at Motley Crue objectively, come on.
Yeah.
You're doing it wrong if you're doing that, BJ.
Right.
Like, Nikki and Tommy are just locked in on this, like a nice sleazy groove, you know, it's so great. Like, you hear a little bit of their Aerosmith kind of groove influence on this kind of stuff, I think, you know?
Reach down low, slide it in real slow. I don't think you have too much time to go too slow. It's only 10 seconds, baby. Yeah,
and then
so.
We talk about the second half of the lyrics on this, right? We're now Vince is talking about Now Vince is talking about second orgasm, right? Where he's saying that you feel stupid. Do you want some more? I got one more shot. My gun's still warm, right? Because he's saying, hey, I can go again
if you want. See, I always thought that this might have set up there with Mr. Speed by Kiss as like unfortunate song title.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, what are you really bragging about?
Then he lets her know again, another chorus, 10 seconds of love. And then the outro, he's asking her, like, was it hot for you? Did you fire this round? So now he's being polite again. He's cordially asking her if she did.
There's no being polite here.
Because he's saying,
he's
like,
giving her a 10-second warning. That's the polite part.
But then he's also
giving her a heads up.
Saying the second I'm through, I'm leaving this town. So he's saying, like, as soon as I'm done, I gotta roll. So he's saying, if you didn't get off, now's the time to do it, right?
So it's really a gentleman's look at a gangbang or something. It's a gentleman's way of looking at things.
Exactly, yeah. Everybody's there for a good time.
It's classy. So when he came, he had his pinky extended. It was the classy way of doing it.
Exactly.
Well, isn't it like, isn't this an instance of you've already got the music laid down and you're going to record the vocals, but you don't have any lyrics, so this is what you came up with, 5 seconds, 10 seconds
before?
10 seconds to record.
That's how it's.
I'll just make some shit up. Just, you know, Vince, like, you know, kneels down on the floor of the studio and scribbles this shit out right before he sings it. I mean, that's kind of what it seems like.
So, going off of Lee McCormick's gentlemanly love story here, you know, when he says, pull my trigger, my gun is loaded with your love. So this is a round specifically set aside just for her.
He's definitely going to give it to her, yeah.
That's magical. That's
for her.
Magical.
It's a gift. It's a gift he's giving her, right?
Right. She can share it with a girlfriend maybe too, right?
Yeah.
He's going to make a star out of her.
And then he rhymes inject it with photograph it, right?
Inject it, photograph me. Fucking great, man. Come
yeah,
on.
Vince Neil could take those two words and actually make them rhyme
only
somehow.
Only...
Oh, God.
Reach down real slow, slide it in real slow. I want to hear your engine roar before I'm out the door. That, again, he's being polite, letting her know that I'm getting ready to book, so. Yeah. Plus, he also shares with his friends. He's very a generous person that's going to come in 10 seconds.
Actually, maybe he's saying, this has gone on long enough. I'll give you 10 more seconds for you to climax, and then I'm leaving. So you got 10
yeah,
more
maybe
seconds.
That's what he's saying. The second half.
He's like, this has gone on too long. I'll give you 10 more seconds. That's it.
He literally can't feel anything from the waist down at this point.
Oh, God. I just got nothing to add. That's just so eloquent. That's like...
Joe, you might want to tell your wife you're not on this episode.
And during all the live shows, this would be like an extended version where they would have a big breakdown section.
20 minutes long.
Really? Extended version of this?
Yeah, he'd ask everybody. He'd be like, who likes pussy out there and all this stuff? Right?
Really? Are you serious?
Wait a second. Let's frame that. The gentleman's, who likes pussy out there, right? Pinky extended.
Yeah.
Ooh. Rather. Ooh. Some more. I got one more shot before I'm out the door. 10 seconds of love. 10 seconds of love. Pull my trigger. I'm gonna blow it with your love. Yeah. 10 seconds of love.
All right, so that brings us to the last song of the album.
Yeah, Danger. Now this is the power ballad. This is what I thought would be the power ballad.
Yeah, this is the ballad. Yeah. Probably my least favorite song in the album besides Helter Skelter.
It's kind of autobiographical, I guess. It's about the band kind of making it in Hollywood, I guess. You know, getting sucked into that lifestyle, you know, making it to the big time finally, and how it's dangerous. You can get trapped by some things, perils of success.
I think that this is the most intelligent song.
It's intelligent. Seriously.
This is the most intelligent song off this album. I mean, there's some lyrical depth to it, right? Compared to everything else, it's the sliding scale. But there is some actual, like, hey, let's do something here with this one.
There's a really cool drum fill Tommy does. They have these pre-choruses, right? It's like, I'm a wildcat, da-na-na, shotgun blast, man. And then, like, Tommy does this fill. Oh, it's so great. I love that fill, man. Yeah. Tommy Lee on this record, so great. And I got stressed when I was learning drums. You know, Tommy Lee was a guy I emulated. And, you know, I would be in class, like music class in school, and I would be doing all these fills where I would, you know, choke the cymbals and all the cowbell stuff. And, you know, he really had a style, Tommy Lee.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
This is actually a good song. Yeah, I'm surprised you don't like it. Right.
It's not that great.
But yeah, again, this album is a game changer. It's one of the best things they ever did. I don't think they ever touched it again, honestly.
It's classic. I own the cassette. Yeah. I own the CD. I own the vinyl. It's one of those records. I got everything. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great album, and it's a great example. It's just so set in the 80s, you know?
This is my favorite out of the catalog easily. Mm-hmm. I don't think they topped this. They did as well, but they didn't top it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is my favorite. I put, you know, Too Fast for Love close second, but you know, this one is by far, you know.
To be honest with you, if this was the last thing they ever did, what a hell of a way to go out, huh?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah.
They had a lot of great moments coming up, man. And they love the way they changed their style, right? They're never gonna go back to this thing. They're never gonna duplicate this record ever again. So why not go off in different directions and see what can happen?
Right.
Like image-wise and vibe-wise, this is obviously the pinnacle of Motley Crue. I mean, this is the ultimate. This is the coolest.
As far as I'm concerned.
But imagine if they tried to knock out like three or four more records after this in the same style with the same.
They would have died. Yeah, they would have died.
Right. So they go out and for the very next thing they do is they change their look and they put out like the biggest power ballad ever. Right. Like totally opposite song to.
Well, like it got really fucking confusing fast to be in a band in the 80s. Because which direction do we go? Right. You've got everybody from Prince and Van Halen and Huey Lewis in the News, and everything was happening, right? It was such an insane time creatively, and there was no real genres anymore. It seemed like anything could get played anywhere. And Motley Crue was smart to change on each thing because they became the trendsetter in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, it might have started out, hey, let's all look like Mad Max, right? But then by the time that the other bands were Mad Maxing it up, I'm looking at you, Dokken, and Rat, Motley Crue was glam, and it changed everything again real fast. And, you know, whether you want to admit it or not, Guns N' Roses gets all this prop for you know, bringing the harder edge and the look of the biker thing back. But it was Motley Crue that was there first. I mean, they went from this to the biker look, and then even bands like Kiss. I mean, everyone says Revenge is such a great album, and I think part of that is because for the first time in years, Kiss looked cool again. And I think that a lot of times we listen to music with our eyes. So
yeah, sure. And there's some truth to that too, because there was a big long gap, or it felt like it, but between Theater Pain and Girls, 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 it's only 2 years, but 2 years in the music industry is a lot of time.
At that time, the '80s, yeah, 2 years was a long time.
And in their absence, that's when you had Poison come out and rise to fame, because Poison was kind of like, well, Motley Crue's not around doing this thing. We're going to do it, and basically kind of not stole their thunder, but they were providing people with something that they didn't have. Crue sees this and goes, well, we're going to come back with something completely different, which is kind of exactly what Lee's saying. It's like, rather than just come back and do the same exact thing, we're just going to take it to a whole nother level. Or hold different level.
Are you a leader or a follower, right? You
know, right. Like every band who was really super successful through the 80s changed with every album. They were all leaders. They weren't followers. If you were a follower, you didn't stick around too long.
All right. Show to the devil, man.
It's a great moment in time. It's like a time capsule, really.
Yeah.
Don't you know by now? Through all the lonely nights, I finally see the light. I can see the street lights burning, love not black and white. And I'm still alive, and I will survive. Yeah, come on, baby, well, I will survive. The future, it's just one dark cloud. Let's leave it to the suffragettes. You won't get me waiting too long. But I can see the street lights burning, love not black and white. And I'm still alive, and I will survive. Well, come on, baby. As the skies return to red,
yeah.
you know I'm a dreamer, but my heart's of gold. I had to run away high so I wouldn't come home low. Just when things went right doesn't mean they're always wrong. Take this song and you'll never feel left all alone. Take me to your heart, fill me in your bones. Just one more night and I'm coming off this long winding road. I'm on my way, I'm on my way, sweet home. Tonight, tonight, I'm on my way.
It just seems so normal. We're out of beer, let's go down the street. Vince had just gotten a new car and decided to take Razzle down and buy some beer.